except if it, you know, you want to get drunk and drive your car and be careless. No, thou shalt not kill. And those who still want to play with killing as a solution, as far as I'm concerned, still get to come back here till they
get it right.
Their souls or spirits figure it out. And I do believe in many dimensions. I'm not saying that, you know, we're going to, if we figured out not to kill, we get to die and go to heaven. I think it's much more complex than that. This is an incredible creator, and the arrogance of anyone who thinks that we're the only, you know, this earth is the only
conscious
living,
dimension.
Breathing example of God's incredible creativity and omniscient wonders, you know, is somebody living in a lot of fear. You know, it's a big universe out there, and we come in many forms, and intelligence manifests in many ways, and anybody who owns a pet knows that. So if we got pets, we got extraterrestrials. You know, there's lots going on in this universe, and, you know, to stand and wonder at what's been created, and even that which appears, problematic, you know, if we truly think we're spiritual beings, how do we act in ways that will allow our spirits to fully reflect, you know, the Creator?
I think if all of us started our day like that and thought about it many times throughout the day, we'd have a very different country and a very different world that we would be living in.
Well, that's the challenge, and
it really is.
You know, it's in front of us very clearly right now, and that's what I'm going to be trying to do. But I'm not perfect. But I appreciate the conversation with you, and again to have it on a network that is about spirit.
Well, I hope the folks out there are listening carefully to your words, because, you know, many, many times I ask myself kind of that same question. Here, the way I look upon the world, looking out with George Bush beating the war drums and everything that's going on, I feel like it's the world right now is like this huge, insane asylum. And I find myself in the middle of this huge, insane asylum, and it says, what do I do? How do I handle this on a day-to-day basis? And it's not always easy. But
as a doctor, you know, when you deal with somebody whose body is out of order, you look in terms of, you know, what do they need? What aren't they getting? You know nutrition, so you know maybe certain diseases are a manifestation of not enough of this nutrient or that nutrient, or, you know, and so I want to bring that understanding into my political work because... You know, what is missing? What's missing on the planet? Love.
Very simply.
Love. You know, and not just words, but, you know, how do we, you know, maintain that if we truly believe that we are spirit and that we come from a higher consciousness, then we have to get into that place that we trust that. And act from that trust rather than from the fear that that's not true, but act from the trust that it is true.
Wonderful words to end the program. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for holding the space.
Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. We need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And, but please hold your calls. We have with us David Earl Johnson, and we're going to be talking about coming war in the Middle East. We're going to be talking about the Muslim religion. And as somebody said, certainly not all Muslims are terrorists, but every terrorist who tracked America was a Muslim. And of course, this idea that we can't have racial profiling, we have to search the little 85-year-old lady at the airport, but we can't profile Muslim men. Well, I would think that if I were a Muslim man in America, knowing what the situation is, I would want to be very, very sure that if there was somebody else on the plane with me who was a Muslim man, that he wasn't a terrorist, because my life would be very much at stake. And of course, what's happened is that the FBI now has been given all sorts of new additional powers. One of those, of course, is to begin to monitor churches. They can begin to monitor libraries to see what books people are taking out. Now, I would simply ask our listeners a very simple question. How many of the terrorists who attacked the United States on September 11th went to churches? How many of them do you think went? None of them went to church. They went to mosques. And so I would not be concerned about what's going on in the churches. If I was really serious in the war on terrorism, I'd be monitoring what's going on in the mosques. And I wouldn't be concerned about what the 85-year-old white grandmother is reading at the library. I'd be concerned about what the Muslim extremist or the people who are of a Muslim faith who may well be associated with Al-Qaeda, who are of this mindset of hatred of Israel and hatred of infidels and the whole Muslim worldview, what they are doing. Because the terrorism we face has nothing to do with the white Christian community, and yet, of course, that is what people in Washington, D.C. are really focusing on. And the question is, are they really serious about the war on terrorism, or is this being used for another purpose? Well, let's get to our special guest this evening. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Hello. Yes, it's good to be with you, Dr. Stan. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. So why don't you sort of introduce yourself to our listeners? And, of course, we're talking to people up in the great Northwest, in the state of Washington, in northern Oregon, and western Idaho. And you've been with us before. Of course, I know who you are and your background, but they don't. So why don't you tell them who you are, why you're concerned about this subject, why you've written so extensively about it?
Well, I first began to learn about Islam, well, I guess when I was a kid, and my father was overseas and was in Iraq and was in Syria and was in Jordan and was in Egypt and was in Saudi Arabia, in all of those countries, and came back and told me stories about the Islamists and so on. Now, in those days, one was not worried about them. It was just a cranky religion that didn't mean much. However, in the early 60s, I went to Beirut for some time and stayed there and lived there and got to know a lot more about them. And actually, I was in a missionary organization there, and we were taught extensively about Islam there. Went from there to my first visit to Jerusalem, and then visited Jerusalem more than 60 times since then, during which time I made friends with Muslim Arabs, with Christian Arabs, with Jews, and with Christian Europeans and Americans. And everywhere I went, I learned as much as I could. I know how to keep my mouth shut and listen. So the culmination of this is, after 39 years of studying this cult, I have found that it's time for me to say something. And I have said something so far in three books, that two of them are totally about Islam and one of them is partially about Islam. And I am currently working on a third book about Islam, and going to be doing some study in Europe and Africa about it in December. So I have, in the last few months, spent a lot of time speaking in churches all over the country, and not only speaking, but also answering questions. And I have found a tremendous surge of interest in the churches in doing something about it.
Well, you know, one of the things that really bothers me is this idea, well, all the monotheistic religions worship the same God.
Yeah.
Well, of course, the God of the Old Testament is the God of the New Testament, but the God of the monotheistic religion of Muhammad it has nothing to do with Jehovah the Bible. I mean, this is isn't this really a pagan moon god?
Absolutely.
And the average individual doesn't know that. Obviously, the president doesn't know that, because he said we all worship the same God, and he invites these Muslim clerics to the White House and to the National Cathedral to worship together in our common God.
Well,
what
course,
in heaven's name is he thinking?
Well, obviously, he doesn't know what we know, and I don't think he wants to know, because it's just not part of his agenda, is it? What about the Pope saying that Allah is the same as God? Well, obviously, you'd think that the Pope would know better than that. But on the other hand, I don't even know what God the Pope believes in. So, you know, maybe he is the same as his God.
Well, the God of the Catholic Church, I mean, the Catholic Church has been traditionally a religious, a Christian religion. We have some problems with the Catholic Church because, you know, the forces of darkness have gotten in the very high levels. But traditional Catholics believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ, and that was the traditional Catholic belief.
Well, I don't know I'm not so sure about that, especially the Vatican itself.
Well, there are problems in the Vatican. In fact, I think it was Pope Paul VI who talked about the smoke of Satan circulating over the top of the Vatican, and he wasn't around very long after he said that.
No, he wouldn't be. But actually, we don't need to be talking about the Catholic
right.
Church, I guess. I really shouldn't have gone off on that tangent.
Right. Let's stick right here to the Mohammedan Church, because... Go ahead.
Well, you know, there are some very serious misconceptions in the United States about Islam. They have been fed to us by the educational system. They've been fed to us by the media, and they've been fed to us by our government. And I'll just run through two or three of those things very quickly, and perhaps we'll enlarge on that later. But one of them is that it's a viable religion, that it's, quote, one of the three great religions. Well, this is absolute poppycock. It's not one of the three great religions. They are totally different, and this is a man-made religion inspired by Satan. And then another misconception is that only a few Muslims are violent. No, there are millions and millions and millions of Muslims who are totally violent, and they're proving it in other countries, but we don't see it here because our media does not choose to let us know what is going on in those other countries. And then another one is that Islam teaches peace. Well, no, Islam teaches that people should live by the Quran. And if you read the Quran, only a few verses, you find out very quickly that it is a religion of hatred and a religion of violence.
Well, isn't just the peace that the Muslim speaks of is when everybody is a Muslim.
Ah, yes, of course. And, you know, another one of the misconceptions is we only have to worry about Iraq and Osama bin Laden. So Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden are the only two people in the whole world we've got to worry about. Well, that's absolutely untrue, because the worldwide Islamic jihad is being led by Saudi Arabia right out of Mecca and Riyadh, which is where Islam began, and it is worldwide, and it involves all Muslims, because every Muslim who is ever born is taught that he has to fight against the infidel, and the infidel is every Christian, every Jew, and to some extent, people of other religions.
But aren't there some peaceful Muslims who just sort of want to live their life and, you know, not not have to fight with anybody?
That's right, and there are some peaceful Christians who only go to church on Easter and Christmas.
Right.
You see, but my problem with that is that if we teach people that a lot of Muslims are peaceful, we forget the fact that when the jihad really gets going in this country, as it has in other countries, that those peaceful Muslims are going to be forced to become violent Muslims.
And I think that's really a very, very valid point, because there have been a number of articles in the even in the New York Times recently pointing out that the Palestinians, Muslims, who live in the Palestinian part of Israel, who want to get along with the Israelis and don't want to be involved in the jihad, they get killed. I mean, they slaughter the whole family because they don't want to go along with the jihad. And, you know, that's a pretty good method of convincing those who want to be peaceful that you've got to choose up one side or the other. And that's the tragedy. There is no middle ground in this this struggle that's going on today.
And once again, Stan, we go back to the Quran, which is the core of Islam, and here's what it says. Take not Jews and Christians for friends, specifically Jews, Christians. They are friends to one another. He among you who takes them for friends is one of them. So if you take a Jew or a Christian for a friend, then you are one of them, which makes you an unbeliever, an infidel, which means that you have to die unless you return to Allah.
And I think that's really so interesting that most people don't understand that if you live in a Muslim country and you convert to Christianity, they will simply kill you.
Absolutely.
But of course, they want to come here and they want all the rights and privileges, and oh, how terrible it is if any there's such a thing as racial discrimination. Mm-hmm. Yet, of course, we're told we're at war, we're in the middle of a war, we're at war with this component of the Middle Eastern, with Middle Eastern men, and we have to do racial profile if we're really serious about this war on terrorism, or is this perhaps not exactly as it's purported to be? Are we being manipulated? Are we being manipulated into a war in the Middle East, which I fear will literally open the gates of hell there, because I think it will involve not simply Iraq, but all of the Middle East, and will inflame not over the Muslims throughout the world, but the Muslims right here in America against this nation?
Well, you know, Stan, there is no point in going after Saddam Hussein. The only reason that I would say is valid for doing that is to stop him nuking Israel.
No, I think what we ought to do is tell Israel, go after and take out his nukes, because if he has any, they know it. I mean, their intelligence has always been superior.
And they also have the means to take care of it. They did it before, and they'll do it again if America will take her hands off of Israel and let her rip.
And I think people have forgotten it. Back in 1981, why the Israel simply set a strike force in, half a dozen planes or bombers, and they just took out Saddam's nuclear sites.
Nuclear power plant.
Right. He was actually working on, I think it was much more than, you know, a nuclear power plant. They were actually working on the nuclear bombs at that time, and that was the end of it.
Of course.
And Israel could do that, but we won't let them. Oh, we just have to have peace over there, and we don't want to get anybody ruffled. Yes, so we don't want you to do it. We're going to send our boys in, and we're going to ignite a flame in the heart of Islam. And, of course, it's like starting a fire in a dry forest. You never know what's going to happen.
You know, Stan, their policy, their plan is to get us concentrating on things that are going on the other side of the world and forget about what is happening in America.
I agree with you totally. So what is happening in America?
Well, Farmer George is over in the pig pen of the farmer down the road trying to stop a dove from attacking the pigs. Now, it's not a good analogy, but that's where he is. Meanwhile, Farmer George's in-house is being attacked by 8 million foxes. We have 8 million Islamist foxes in this country, and we're doing nothing serious about it. We're detaining 5 guys who were overheard in a restaurant talking about September 11th and what they were going to do and all this kind of stuff. But we're not doing anything serious. Did you see for hours and hours and hours on end those policemen and FBI agents boasting about what they had done? They detained these guys. Big deal. But what about the thousands and thousands of other militant Arab, Islamic, violence-prone criminals who are in this country, and hundred thousand of them who are here illegally, that they don't even know where they are? Why are we not looking for them?
Well, I will tell you why. The latest issue of the WorldNet Daily had an article on this, and they said that they'd interviewed a number of people for immigration. And, of course, many times when Muslim people are coming to this country, everybody goes to the airport to meet them. And, of course, the immigration people wanted them to pick up Muslims who were here illegally. And the administration, to this day, is discouraging doing anything about or trying to arrest Muslims who are living in this country illegally. Now, there's something wrong with this whole scenario if we're really at war with terrorism. And this was one of their complaints, that and the fact that if you are a Muslim terrorist, you can go to Canada and get a passport, and you can come into America and stay as long as you want to. If you are a Muslim from a country that is known to be a terrorist nation on the terrorist watch list, but you have permanent residence here and you go out of the country, when you come back in, the airlines have been told to stamp citizenship as American citizenship, and so these people can come back in, and of course they are not questioned by immigration to find out if they've been to an Al-Qaeda training camp, because they are considered to be American citizens, even though they're not American citizens. They simply have a permanent residence here, and of course instead of trying to track down the Muslim terrorists, they're doing everything they can to impede the Immigration and Naturalization Service from doing what's logical. They haven't sealed our borders. In fact, there's an increase, in my understanding, an increased influx of Muslim terrorists right now in preparation for the coming war, because when that war comes about, they're going to unleash the gates of hell, not only in the Middle East, but right here in America.
Yep. You know, another of those mistakes that we have in our concept of Islam is that Osama bin Laden declared war on America in 2001.
No, he declared war about 1995.
Well, no. Really. Mohammed declared war 1,400 years ago.
Okay, good.
And there
point.
Have been skirmishes and battles ever since, and this is just one more of them. Bin Laden never declared war. He's just following his master.
Well, of course, he's called on a number of occasions for killing Americans and killing tourists, and on several occasions, you know, he's declared a jihad in America, and I think the first one was 1995 or 1996. And after he had done that and encouraged people all throughout the world to kill Americans and kill tourists, when the Saudi government offered to turn him over to the Clinton administration, they wouldn't take him. This is the government of the Sudan. When the government of the Sudan offered to turn him over, when the government of the Sudan offered to turn him over to Saudi Arabia, they wouldn't take him. So there's much more to this story than the average American has ever been allowed to understand.
Well, there's a lot more to a lot of stories, and I have to compliment you, by the way, Dr. Stan, about on your book.
Oh, have you read that?
I haven't quite finished it, but I have read a lot of it. And a lot of it makes a lot of sense. You know, the things that are going on in this country, apart from the Islam situation, one of them, of course, is the globalization. You know, why is it that when you go into a Walmart store that was declared by Sam Walton 20 years ago that they would sell only American goods wherever possible, and now you go into the Walmart store and it's 90% Chinese goods on almost every aisle. Why is it that I bought a pair of pants, two pairs of pants from Heyband Company, by over the internet a few weeks ago, and I got two pairs of pants that were supposed to be identical. One of them was made in Mongolia, and the other one was made in Syria, one of our major enemies. Why is it?
They call it globalization.
Yes, exactly. And so what is that? It is destroying the American economy. It's taking away jobs from Americans. It's closing down American factories and moving them either across the border to Mexico or, worse than ever, all the way to China. And we are making the Chinese a very rich nation in that area of the globe. And we are giving them the money wherewith to build strategic weapons, to build not only enough weapons to fight us with, but enough weapons to sell to half of the Arab armies in the world, and guidance systems given to them by Clinton that make it possible for them to aim those weapons directly at American cities and reach them.
And not only that, but of course China has sold missile technology to Iran, to Syria, to Libya, and probably to Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. So we have done, and I don't really for one minute believe Bill Clinton gave that technology for the campaign contributions. Certainly he took the campaign contributions, but there's far more to this than meets the eye.
He did it for ideological reasons.
Right, and of course we are we are arming the rest of the world in preparation for a great battle that's going to take place.
Uh-huh.
And I believe behind that are these spiritual forces I wrote about in my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. Well, we've got Mike on the line here, calling from, of all places, Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. The one question with Islam, now, are they not the descendants of Ishmael?
All right, fine. The question is, aren't the Arabs the descendants of Ishmael?
Well, you know, some of them are and some of them aren't. And if we're talking about Islamists, which is the way the question was phrased, you don't have to be an Arab to be an Islamist. You can be an American, you can be an Anglo-Saxon, you can be British, you can be Indonesian. There's so many of them over there. You can come from anywhere in the world.
Filipino, right.
Yes, Philippines. And you can be an Islamist. So, and that's another one of the fallacies, that we have to expect that all Islamists are going to be wearing an Arab kafiyah, you know, a headdress. But not necessarily so, because the people in Indonesia sure don't. They wear a little cap on the top of their head, and that's it. You wouldn't know them. You wouldn't know why they're wearing it.
Yeah, but Ishmael, he was, and his descendants, he was going to be a donkey of a man, right?
Yeah.
And he was going to caused problems everywhere he went to his brothers.
Yeah.
Well, that was, of course, is the Arab in contrast to the Muslim.
You're absolutely right, though. Yes.
Okay. Anything else, Mike?
The other thing is was basically that he was going to cause trouble, and that's basically what Islam has been doing.
Right.
So.
Well, you know, apart from that, I mean, you're absolutely right, and I'm not arguing with you on the point, but. But Arabs, generally speaking, have always caused trouble no matter where they are.
That's right.
even before Islam, it's just that they got this phony man-made religion and added that to the problems that they have unleashed on mankind. But you're absolutely right, yeah.
And then, of course, you have some Arabs are Christians. In fact, about 10% of the population of Iraq, my understanding, is Christian. So, the Christian Arab is in a really terrible situation. In fact, Bethlehem used to be primarily a Christian Arab, and they've just literally driven out all the Christian Christian Palestinians out of Bethlehem. And these people, where are they going to go? I mean, they're going to go into Israel. Most of them have been just forced out of that area completely.
Most of them have come to the United
right.
States. I have a lot of friends from Bethlehem who have moved to the U.S.
Christian Palestinians?
Yeah, Christian
right.
Palestinian Arabs, yes. Right. They had lost everything because they were not even able to sell their businesses or their homes.
Right.
They had to just leave with whatever they could take with them.
But I'll tell you what, they're good, industrious people. And, you know, I feel terribly sorry for them, but, you know, they will do well wherever they go.
Well, you know, another place that had and still does have quite a large Christian population is Lebanon. Now, these are not, strictly speaking, Arabs, although most people would think they are. They're not. The Lebanese are Phoenicians, which is a different race altogether.
Right.
Just as the Egyptians are not Arabs either. They're Egyptian. although, of course, the Arabs came down there and mixed with them and produced children, of course, with the Egyptians.
And, of course, you've got the Edomites and the Moabites and all of these other groups as well. So
in Lebanon, when I was there, first of all, in the 60s, there was 60% Christian and 40% Muslim. Now it's pretty much reversed itself. In the Lebanese constitution, the prime minister has to be Muslim, but the president has to be Christian. I don't think they've changed that constitution. I think it remains. But the problem in Lebanon, of course, is the Syrians. It's the Syrians who are running Lebanon. It's the Syrian army that is there controlling everything. And the Lebanese don't have a chance to do anything. There are so many complex situations around the Middle East with different groups of people who are not, strictly speaking, Arabs. In fact, the only real Arabs are the ones who live in Saudi Arabia or who migrated from Saudi Arabia, like, for instance, the king of Iraq and the king of Jordan, the Hashemites. They are originally from Saudi Arabia, but they were given this throne by the British as part of their plan for the Middle East. And the people in Jordan are almost, well, a very large majority of them are Palestinians. So they don't agree with the Hashemite kingdom at all.
And they would come from the Philistines and the Edomites. And anyway, anything else, Mike?
No, that was it.
All right, thanks very much for calling.
Thanks, Mike.
And of course, somebody else had called in and asked if Muhammad tied his heritage to Ishmael and the whole idea of being the offspring of Abraham. Is that brought out in the Quran, the relationship between the Arab and Abraham?
Yes, it is indeed, because the Quranic story is that Islam began in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve, and that Abraham was a prophet of Islam, as was Moses, Elijah, and of course Jesus. All of them were prophets of Islam. According to the Quran, according to their beliefs, they were prophets of Islam, but all of them merely pointed the way to the real prophet, the one and only major prophet of Islam, who, of course, was Muhammad.
You mean Allah is God and Muhammad is his prophet, isn't that what you're saying?
That's it.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Now, we're going to have to take a break in just a few minutes, but when we get back, why, we welcome your calls. Our guest today is David Earl Johnson, and we're talking about Islam, and we'll let you know about his books and where you can order them. And, of course, it's so important today that you understand what this is really all about. We are not fighting terrorism. We're fighting Islamic extremists. And, of course, when our government says that we're going to have the FBI agents in the name of fighting terrorism begin, of course, going into churches and monitoring churches in America, you begin to get the idea that maybe just maybe we're not really serious about fighting terrorism. We're really going to be fighting Christianity. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when, of course, we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there across America listening to our programs, we hope that many of you will decide you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day, bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, a historical perspective of what's going on, and hopefully you will be one of the people who understands what is really going on when everybody else is frantically trying to come up with an explanation. And one of the most rewarding things I do is in my talks and trying to educate people and then having them come in and with a clear, concise picture of what's going on. And it means, of course, that they begin to understand they can think outside the box. They no longer are simply repeating the lies they're told on ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN, but now they can see through the glass clearly. And that's really what our hope is. So if you'd like to, of course, give us a call and join the Radio Liberty family, or you're interested in partnering with us in what we do, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Now, if you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters, our July newsletter dealt with vaccinations. Our August newsletter dealt with the Oklahoma City bombing, and the fact that it was tied into the Islamic terrorists, and, of course, the government tied that up, covered that up. And of course, although it's not mentioned in the newsletter, they also covered up the fact that the Islamists were involved in the downing of TW-800. If you doubt that, you need to read the book written by the director of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare, a man named Joseph Badansky. His book is Bin Laden, the Man Who Declared War Against America. But everything has been cover-up, lies, deceit, treachery, until, of course, it came time when the script was to be played out. And, of course, we saw the tragedy of what happened on September 11th. And then, of course, faced with the situation where 15 of the 19 terrorists had come from Saudi Arabia. They were Saudi Arabian citizens. We went to war with Afghanistan, and now we're going to go to war with Iraq. It's quite logical if you're not thinking very clearly. If you are thinking very clearly, you're going to ask yourself, what in heaven's name is going on? I mean, what's wrong with the picture of what we're seeing? And, of course, if you get some of our material, our new video entitled 911 Contrived, why you begin to understand that reality has very little to do with perception. So if you'd like, of course, to get one of our newsletters, and you do that by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We encourage you to go to our website, which is radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And then, of course, we ask you to tell others about the programs, to tell others about the website at radioliberty.com. We remind you that if you're in the Northwest, we do a program every Saturday at 10 o'clock in the morning. And, of course, we want you listening. We want you telling others about the program. We want you, of course, to help us to get the word out in your area. And you can't reach everybody. I can't reach everybody. But together, I can reach you, and you can reach others, and those others can reach others. And the more people who can understand what's really going on, the better our chance of perhaps having some impact in this amazing spiritual battle which is being fought today. Maybe we're just talking to the remnant. I don't know. But I'm called to do what I do. I hope you are called as well.
Yeah.
Because each one of us is involved in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation initially conceived under God can long endure. Or if in this coming great world war which we are entering, America will be simply cut part of the aspen of history. So again, our number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America will soon be engaged in a war that will shake the very foundations of this nation. And remember that number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, Dr. Stan, and our guest is David Earl Johnson. Our telephone number is, of course, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you're here on the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. And why don't you just tell our listeners how they can get hold of your books? We can't necessarily mention the price on the station, but if you'd like to tell them how they could get hold of you, if they wanted to find out more about how to get your books, you certainly can do that.
Yes, there are a couple of ways, Stan. First of all, they could call our 800 number, 800-632-0979. And do that, please, during the day and preferably between 9 and 5 Eastern time, because we are on the East Coast. They can also contact me by email by going to our website, which is davidjohnsonbooks.com. All, as always, one word, davidjohnsonbooks.com. We'd be glad to...
Let them know about it. Now, the other thing is that you are going around across the country giving lectures at to churches. Would you like to just mention how people could contact you if they wanted perhaps to get you to come into their area or to their church?
Absolutely. They can do it the same way. Call me between 9 and 5 Eastern Time at 800-632-0979. And what we like to do is to come in for a weekend and do a Saturday seminar, two seminars in the afternoon and one in the evening, so we get three separate subjects. And then we'll go to one of the local churches on Sunday morning and again probably Sunday evening. So we do a total of four or five different subjects in the area. And there is no charge. We do obviously expect them to take an offering for us, but we don't fix a rate or a price, as some people do. And we're available to do that anywhere in the country. We can speak on the most dangerous man in America. We can speak on women in Islam. We can speak on why Islam must have Jerusalem, and many more subjects similar to those.
All right, fine. Well, who is the most dangerous man in America?
Oh, well, obviously, I think we all know that it's Louis Farrakhan.
All right, fine. And, of course, I think that's a fascinating subject. And here's a man who travels over to the Islamic countries. Is he actually given money by, I understand that he's had large sums of money given to him by various leaders of those nations over there?
Muammar Gaddafi, when he went on his not the last... large nation tour, but the one before it, a 26-nation tour, which was about 4 years ago, I guess, roughly, Muammar Gaddafi offered him $2 billion to bring about a revolution in the United States. And, of course, the American government would not allow him to bring that money in. So I believe what he did was set up some companies and have goods shipped in to those companies, and he never paid the bills. And of course, the goods that were shipped in were sold by his various enterprises, and that's how he got the money, so he's got it.
Well, of course, I would think that if our government was really serious and didn't want him playing the part that he is, that they would, of course, arrest him for being a foreign agent, agent of a foreign country, and simply not declaring that, because according to law, if you are taking material wealth from a foreign country to push their political agenda in America, you can do that in our free society, but at least you have to declare that. But obviously, Louis Farrakhan must have some very, very powerful friends in high places in America, and within the media, too, because he's constantly being, seen on television and all the major media. People on our side, I mean, the legitimate leaders, nobody ever hears about him. But between Jesse Jackson and Louis Farrakhan, what a couple of terrible examples as leaders of the black community in America.
Well, you know, also he was most recently in Iran and Iraq and was quoted as saying that the American Muslims are praying for a victory for Iraq. And I'm sure everybody saw that in the news. But, you know, what kind of a statement is this? It just shows exactly where the Muslims do stand in America. They are calling for the downfall of America and for the downfall of our government, and Louis Farrakhan certainly aimed at one point to be president of the United States. Of course, he ran as the vice presidential running mate to Jesse Jackson.
Well, of course, the interesting thing is that they have spent hundreds of millions of dollars going into our prisons to recruit blacks in our prisons, the rapists and the murderers there, into the black, so-called black Muslim,
sure,
or Muslim religion. And, of course, much of this is funded by our good friends, the Saudis, who really are behind this whole world terrorist movement and largely funding this with certainly the tacit approval of somebody within our government, because this is never brought before the American people. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, one of the things Farrakhan has said, he has promised his black Muslims that he will open the doors of the prisons and set them all free. And, you know, I've been doing a lot of thinking about this. How in the world could he do that? And, you know, the answer came to me quite subtly and quite simply. All you have to do is recruit the jailers of all of the prisons and jails around the country into, as I said, all of them. Of course, I didn't mean that. But as many black jailers as you possibly can to make them Muslims. And then a very simple scenario would be, and I'm not saying that this is how they're going to do it, but it certainly seems feasible, that at one specific time when they're ready, that, for instance, on Christmas Day, the Muslim jailers would say to all of the Christian jailers, or those who don't believe in anything, who knows, you know, as a gesture of humanity, we are going to allow you to go and stay home on Christmas Day with your families, and we will take care of the jail.
Well, I think that people do not understand that the loyalty of these people is not to country, but to religion. I mean,
absolutely.
They're praying 5 hours a day, five times a day to Allah. Their whole life centers around their religion. Well, of course, the Christian's life should center around his religion as well. But, of course, there's a fanaticism within the Muslim religion. And, when the word is given, when the call comes for jihad, the one thing that the American doesn't understand is that you are a Muslim, you never know you're going to go to paradise. I mean, you have to do good works and you have to follow all the rules, but you're never sure not going to go to hell. But there's one way to get into paradise.
Unless you kill a Christian or a Jew, then you get into paradise for sure.
And I think that people don't understand this. What sort of religion would take you immediately to paradise after you've killed people? In fact, I heard this. I don't know. Did you see that 60-minute interview? I think it was on the 1st of September. When they interviewed a very, very sweet-faced little, looked like an 18-year-old Muslim girl. There were four of them who were seniors in this Muslim high school in Chicago. And, of course, they have everything covered but their face, wearing the shawl and the long dress. And this one said, and they were talking about, you know, the concept of suicide bombing, and they were all in favor of the suicide bombers in Israel. Now, these are girls living in Chicago, born in America, raised in America.
Yep.
And of course, and one of them said, why, if I went into a naval base and blew myself up, I would immediately go to paradise. And, of course, this was on film. Well, I guess somebody afterwards said, do you realize what you've told the American people?
Mm-hmm.
That we would go in and blow up their naval base? So she called CBS and she said, well, I really meant if I went into an Israeli naval base and blew myself up. Well, what are the chances she's going to be able to get close to an Israeli naval base? What are the chances she's going
America.
To get close to an American naval base?
Yes, right.
And this is what was in her mind when she was speaking.
Of course.
People find that difficult to believe.
Damn.
I mean, the answer, of course, is the love of Jesus Christ. That's what we have to offer these people.
Yeah. Stan, if you hear of anybody who has a copy of that tape, a VCR copy, a video copy, I sure would like to have it, because I did not see that one, and it's very important to me to get it if I can.
Well, actually, I could, I'll try to remember, and if I don't, you call me off the air, because there is a telephone number that you can actually call, and I think for $25 they'll send you the tape.
Mm.
And I usually go ahead and get the text of that, if I'm going to use that in some of my work. I saw it. I watched it. I wished afterwards that we'd taped that. But
yeah.
I can tell you exactly how to get the video
okay.
of it.
Okay, great.
Okay, so if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, give us a call. But you have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, that there, I believe that so much of what's going on today is really scripted. And during the Vietnam War in 1965, when so many of our people were consumed seeing the flag-draped coffins of our boys coming home from Vietnam and the weeping mothers and widows, why, the people in Washington, D.C., the wicked ones, repealed the McCarran Immigration Act and opened up our borders to people of all races and all languages because they wanted a multicultural society because they knew it would eventually lead to the destruction of America. They wanted a society where people didn't come here and become Americans, but they would retain their own customs and their own language, and that's why everything has been done to prevent America from being the official language of this country, to insist that people who come here and want to be citizens have to be able to read our language and understand our way of life, because they don't want that at all. They want to be able to play American against American, and how wonderful it will be now that they have all of this fifth column in America of people who are prepared to die so that they can get into paradise.
Yep. Stan, I wanted to go back to something we were saying a few minutes ago about places I go to speak in churches and relative to prisons, et cetera. I'm going to go to a very small town in a southern state in a couple of weeks from now to speak in a church, and the pastor told me there is a mosque being built in our town. I said, why would they build anything in that town? It's so small, it can hardly use two churches. And I got thinking about that. And I called him back. I said, Pastor, is there a prison near you? And he said, yes, a big one. And then I went on the Internet, and I checked in the state prison information, and I find there's not one but two very large prisons around where they're building that mosque.
And in other words, you're thinking that the jailers will be Muslims, and of course they'll be needing a mosque to go to.
That's right. Well, not only that, but they are going to convert those jailers who are not Muslim, give them a mosque in which to worship, teach them what to do, and then give them the marching orders to open up the prison to release the prisoners when Farrakhan tells them the time has come.
And of course, here is Louis Farrakhan, who hates America. He's the one who's trying to push this idea of reparations for slavery. And I say any person living today who was a slave certainly is entitled to reparations, but they're not going to find very many that could take that.
No, but we could find several million slaves in Sudan and in Nigeria, who are Christians, and their masters are Muslim today. Mm-hmm. Millions, literally millions of slaves.
But the thing is, why does the media give Farrakhan even a hearing? And the only reason they do is he's playing his part. And just as Jesse Jackson is playing his part, until people begin to understand
you
this.
You know what, Stan?
Right.
I got to tell you this. Farrakhan is a good-looking guy. He's intelligent. But he gets his face out there in public. My point being that the people who are listening to you on the radio don't know what you look like unless they buy your book.
And then they wouldn't recognize me because that picture was taken about that.
I know it was.
Years ago.
I know it was, but my wife, when she saw that picture, went right out and booked a flight to California, but I wouldn't tell her where you live. Oh, dear.
Well, anyway, our listeners out there must understand that America's in real trouble today, and I believe that God judges nations as it judges people. And, of course, you can judge people in the afterlife. You judge nations in this life and in this time. And this nation has turned its back on God, and unless there's a revival, unless people turn back to God, why, I see very little future for the survival of Western civilization as we've known it.
Right.
Well, now, of course, you mentioned, of course, the most dangerous man in America today. And then, of course, you mentioned something about the Muslim attitude towards women. I mean, why would any woman want to embrace this philosophy, you know, where you can have four wives, a man can divorce his wife just by saying, I divorced you three times? I mean, this is a really total oppression of women. And, of course, all this, we heard about how terribly the Taliban treat women and you know, of course, this was to get our emotions up against the Taliban, but the Saudis have been doing this for years, and I don't believe that this is right in either case. They focus our attention on the Taliban's mistreatment of women, never on the Muslim treatment of women as a whole.
Yeah, well, you know, American women are always looking for something different, I guess. And I'm not talking about women in general, but I mean there is a certain age and a certain mindset of young women who are looking for something dashing and, you know, the Rudolph Valentino Sheikh, and that means chic in American, by the way. It didn't sound very good. The word is Sheikh. You know, this kind of thing. And, you know, the Italian nobleman. Well, these guys come along and appear to have a lot of money. They're driving very nice sports cars. They seem to have lots of money, and a lot of them do, from their Saudi families. And they sweep the girls off their feet, and the girl doesn't even think for a moment about what she's getting into. And in fact, I was talking to a pastor recently whose daughter married one of these guys, and he found out later that the man had boasted that if we can't convert them, we'll marry them. And if you marry into a pastor's family, how is that pastor going to speak badly of Islam? So there's an actual plan to marry the daughters of ministers.
Well, I can believe it. Some of the things that are going on are just so incredible that it's very difficult to believe. But we've created a situation in America now where some of our towns, like Dearborn, Michigan, is primarily a Muslim town.
Yep.
And there are other places, there, you know, back in the 1960s, there were maybe 20 mosques in America. Today, there are 2,000 mosques in America.
That's right.
And not just in America. You go to France, it's said that in southern France, there are more mosques than there are Christian churches. And the mosques are filled, and the churches are empty. And what does that say about the future of France? And what does it say about the future of America?
That's right. You know, one of the most shocking situations is what is going on in Denmark right now. Denmark, which stood up against the Nazis in World War II, led by their king, and refused to allow their Jews to be transported to the concentration camps. It ended up, I believe, that were 50 Jews actually out of Denmark that went to the camps. All the rest of them survived. But today, Denmark has opened her doors to the Muslims. And there are 200,000 Muslims and only 6,000 Jews. Jews are being beaten up on the streets. There are anti-Jewish riots by these Muslims. And they are, the police and the people can do nothing to stop them. They're just too powerful, and it's only 4% of the population.
Well, of course, they grow up because they have very, very large families, and the Protestants have bought into the lie that, oh, there are too many people in the world. You don't want to have a large family.
Yeah,
it's too expensive. The Muslims are having 6, 8 children, and the of course, this is why Europe is dying. Because, you know, in Italy, 1.2 children per family. It takes 2.2 children or 2.1 children to reproduce. Italy is dying. France is dying. Germany is dying. And soon they're all going to be Muslim nations.
I'm going to England in December, and I'm not prepared for what I know I'm going to find there. That was where I was born. And the last time I was there, about 4 years ago, I was shocked. But this time, I think I'm going to be more shocked. You know, going back just for a second to Denmark, 95% of the rapes in Denmark are perpetrated by Muslims. 95%. And the population of Muslims is only 4%. And similar statistics for other major crimes. And 45% of the welfare purse in Denmark is taken by those 4% Muslims. They're living off the government and raping the women.
Well, it's a sad commentary, but this is what happens when you have this liberal philosophy and when a nation forgets God. That's really, really what happens. Logic would be that you'd want people of your same culture, your same language, your same religion together. Your only reason you do what we have done here and create a multicultural society, which was once a Christian nation, if you wanted intentionally to destroy it. And there's always been a desire to destroy America because it was the beacon of Christianity. It was the beacon of hope for men throughout the world. That, of course, is becoming less and less today.
And so was Great Britain.
Right.
In fact, Britain was even more than America. Just, you know, back in the last century. The beginning of the last century.
Right. And, of course, at one time our pulpits flamed with righteousness, but now they just sort of fizzle up there.
Oh, no, they sing.
Right.
And they tell jokes.
Right. Well, we're just about out of time. We've only got a couple of more minutes here. What are some of the things you'd like our listeners to think about and to contemplate on?
Well, I'm going to give my 800 number again just a moment, but let me just say very simply and very sadly that I sincerely believe that if the church in America does not wake up within 2 years, then in 10 years, you can be sure that you will be a citizen of the United Islamic States of America. They absolutely will take over this country unless the Christians wake up and do something. What do the Christians need to do? One, they need to bring about a God-centered revival in this nation. None of the stupidity that we see on television, the Christian stations, but God-centered revival. And then the other thing they need to do at the very same time is to elect members of Congress who feel as we do and who understand as we do and who will stand up against Islam, will stand up for God, will stand up against the liberals who are in Congress at this time. If we would have a true God-centered revival and a Congress voted in by the people, of the people, for the people, within 2 years, we could turn this thing around. And if we do not, then we are going to be part of the United Islamic States of America.
Well, of course, what people really don't understand is that only half of our people are registered to vote, and barely half of the people who are registered to vote actually vote. You can be sure the Muslims are all voting because they have an objective, they have a goal.
That's
and
right.
And, of course, they know what they're about. The average individual doesn't. We're out of time, David. Thank you so much for being with us again. God bless you, and we'll look forward to having you with us in the not-too-distant future.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. And, of course, this is the time we have to say goodbye to our friends up there in the great Northwest, and so we ask you to pray for America and pray for revival, but please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. We'll be back again tomorrow. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, we're not going to have any call. We will take callers here in a little while. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, but please hold your calls because we have with us in studio Joan Paris, and Joan is just back from Johannesburg, South Africa. Now, while our attention, of course, has been focused on what's going on in the Middle East, one of the most important meetings of modern times was held in Johannesburg, South Africa. They had well over 100 leaders of the nations of the world there. And, of course, all of this has to do with this new world order, this new world religion, with sustainable development, with the transfer of national sovereignty and control of all freedom and every living human being to a centralized authority, which is, whether you want to acknowledge it or not, the effort to bring everyone under the control of the prince of this world, Lucifer. And if you study the writings of many of the people who've been with the United Nations for years, people like Robert Mueller, for 30 years he served with the United Nations, many, many years as the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. Robert Mueller is deeply involved with Luciferian organizations. He wrote his World Core curriculum for schools across the world. And, of course, dedicated that World Core curriculum to Alice Bailey, who was a Luciferian. Her writings, of course, were channeled to her by a demonic spirit. And you have to understand it all fits together, what they did. I'm going to let Joan tell us what actually happened over there. Joan, let's talk first about the Earth Charter. And I understand that the Earth Charter was going to be placed in the Ark of Hope. And, of course, the Earth Charter is to be the modern-day replacement for the outmoded Ten Commandments of God. The Ark of Hope will replace the Ark of the Covenant. And everything that goes on is a mirror image of Christianity and God's plan for mankind. Was it an exciting time, Joan?
Well, it really was. This was a blockbuster conference, Dr. Stan. There were so many venues going on all at one time that it would be very difficult to list everything that was happening, and there was no way to possibly get to or attend everything.
Well, did you sort of divide up forces? Because I know that Joan Vian was there, and I understand there were some of the other women who had gone, and did you have some sort of an organized effort to cover as many different things as you could, or were you sort of each on your own?
We're more, each on our own, because we kind of have our own areas of interest, and you just kind of go where you have an opening or a leading, and there is so much that you can go just about anywhere. Some of these people, you never even see them except for, maybe once or twice you might bump into somebody. But there were places, venues where I was able to go that I never saw anybody that I recognized. The main venue, of course, was the United Nations had their conference at a conference site in downtown Johannesburg, the newer section of Johannesburg, and there were something like 4,000 members of the press registered, that in addition to all of the delegates from around the world. Some countries had hundreds and hundreds of delegates that they brought. And then if you take a map of downtown and just this one massive meeting going on at the convention center had multiple meetings going on. And, of course, you can only cover one thing at one time. And being there as a member of the press, of course, I had access to all of the press conferences, which pulled in the highlights of different things that were going on. But then you also had within a range of many, many miles, for example, a 30, 40-minute bus ride, you had what's called Ubuntu Village, and then you had another venue where all of the NGOs had their booths set up. And it, other than going there to register, I never made it out there because there was so much going on within walking distance. Outside of the conference center, of course, there was a building where the United States State Department had their headquarters, and I was able to go there for a number of briefings. And further down the street from that, say, you know, 6-8 blocks away, there was a bank headquarters building, a huge complex, which housed the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. This is, you know, the granddaddy of the environmental organizations. And they were home to the World Wildlife Fund and many, many site events. I enjoyed going to that venue, the IUCN venue. I was able to get a pass to go in every day. The reason I enjoyed it is because I have kind of summed up in my mind that your NGOs, the people that head the NGOs are what I call the lunatic fringe. These are people who are philosophically, we would consider them to be way, way out there in their environmental agenda. It's the, as you were mentioning, this extreme spiritual environmental agenda. But to me, it's kind of the heartbeat, and it's where the philosophies and the ideas are really promulgated and incubated and hatched. So I did go to a number of venues there. I ran into Stephen Rockefeller there, and then a number of other people. It was a big and an important venue. Across the street from that was a Hilton Hotel. Hilton Hotel was the home of the business venues. The business venue is very, very important. Someone mentioned to me today that one of somebody on the East Coast had declared that this conference was a failure. I have to laugh, having been in so many venues that I was in, to hear that said, because I think if you really understand the agenda, there's nothing failure about it. It's simply marching on as it has been designed and intended to do. And by that, I would say that all of the big people at the UN conference talked about having to move from ideas and goals to action. The action was at the Hilton Hotel with the business community, because what this is all about, when you boil it all down, is a consolidation and control of all the control, all the power, and all of the wealth in the world.
And I think, really, Joan, what's hard for many people to understand is that many of these businesses, many of these international corporations, have no loyalty to America. They have this loyalty as to this internationalist or globalist dream, where the corporations rule the world, or they are part of the ruling elite that, of course, controls the hierarchy. And here you have people of great wealth then establishing their rule over everyone. And this has been the dream down since the beginning of time, you know, to create a world government. And certainly Nimrod tried it, and I'm sure the pharaohs would love to have done that. Alexander the Great did a pretty good job. But, of course, nobody has come as close as these people have. And they're on the very verge of creating this one world government, and it is people of great wealth who are financing. Would that be a fair statement?
That's exactly correct, Dr. Stan. And, you know, I'd have to say that this isn't a sprint. It's a relay. And they keep handing off the baton. And they've been doing this not for 10, 20, 30 years, but for hundreds of years and thousands of years, when you understand the agenda, when you understand that the spiritual impetus that's behind all of this. Originally, you know, the Rio Plus 10 in 92 and the Rio Plus 5, which were, you know, the Earth conferences that were in what we're familiar with in the last decade after the Stockholm Convention in 1972, I recall so vividly being in Rio at the 1997 Rio Plus 5 conference. I remember seeing all of these representatives of the NGOs there. They were given a high profile. They were put in the spotlight. They had their plane tickets paid for. They had their expensive hotel rooms paid for. And NGO members gave me and showed me these little coupons they had that had been printed off and given to them that paid for all of the meals while they were there. the NGOs were really the core. And again, you know, the NGO is kind of like the social misfit that's the foot soldier for the lunatic fringe that heads up most of these non-governmental organizations.
And the NGOs, non-governmental organizations like Sierra Club and the various environmental movements, etc.
Your civil society, it's also called. And what impressed me at this meeting right up front was that the NGOs, yes, they are there, and yes, they have a use and a purpose, but they were no longer in the spotlight. And that's because they have moved from their plan, from their ideas, from their goals, to action. The NGOs in Johannesburg were given a room. They were extremely disorganized. Every event that they had that I saw, your minor NGOs, was extremely disorganized. Therefore, you know, they weren't funded. They weren't. They didn't have the tools that they needed to run their meetings. I walked into one of their meetings. There were maybe six or seven people sitting around a table. It was on spirituality. And they were disoriented, and I said, well, where's Stephen Rockefeller? And they said, well, he won't be here. And I said, oh, I just really wanted to see what's going on with the Earth Charter because I was in his workshop, and of course, such an important component of everything that's going on here. And they said, would you like to lead our roundtable discussion? And I just politely declined and sat for a few minutes and then left. And so that's how bad it was.
When they have to get the representative of KFER to come and lead the roundtable discussion, they are in real trouble. And of course, really, that's so true. You know, I remember up there at the big World Bank meeting they had in Seattle, and they had, of course, the big riots up there. And of course, the rioters were all demanding that, of course, when we have this globalization, why we will include simply a discussion of environmental matters and labor matters, so that as we begin, bringing in all these countries throughout the world and taking their products from these countries, that they will have proper environmental and labor policies. Well, what the average individual who was there demonstrating and burning down buildings didn't understand is they were simply carrying out the concepts of the elite, because that's exactly what the elite are talking about now. Oh, yes, we want, of course, proper environmental and labor policies in the all these countries throughout the world that are being pulled into this world government concept. So they'll begin organizing unions there, and then, of course, they'll begin to affect government policy as far as environmental issues are concerned.
Exactly, and that's the purpose of these useful
idiots. Always.
I didn't want to say it. But.
Go ahead. They're useful idiots. They're well-meaning people with their feet firmly planted in the clouds who don't understand
right. Who's
paying their way, who's putting up the money for them. And just as during the Vietnam era, when we had all the anti-war demonstrators out there, so many of them were actually funded by the Rockefellers and the same people, Exxon, the same people who were pushing the war. So you have your war, and then you have your opposition to the war, but a controlled opposition.
Exactly. And so, you know, it was kind of sad, but it was kind of funny to see the NGOs very frustrated in this venue and, you know, ultimately getting very upset and having kind of a token walkout the last or the second to the last day of the conference. And just to give a little background to the listeners, this, again, is a whole process. The Stockholm meeting in 1972, which is 30 years ago, the United Nations had a conference on human environment. And so that's, in this last century, is kind of what we can look at is the whole progression of this move towards sustainable development. And the focus of that meeting was on unsustainable economic growth. And like we were saying earlier, we need to realize that these people are extremely focused and they're relentless in their pursuit of their agenda. And again, this is something that they've passed on from generation to generation, no matter what form the agenda takes. It's always been about creating a one world order that's built on domination by an elite and control of all of the wealth and power in the world, with Lucifer, the light bearer, as their god and inspiration. That, to me, is the whole kernel of this agenda. So when you understand how resolute they are, then, and you understand what motivates them at their inner core, unless you can understand that, then you, the listener, really can't counteract and overcome ultimately their God and their agenda. So that's the power and that's the force that we're up against. This 1972 conference wasn't followed up on until 30 years later, 20 years later, 1992 at the Rio Earth Summit, where the Rio Principles and Agenda 21 were unveiled, and then the Earth Charter was just getting ready to emerge. And I have to ask, do you really believe that? When I was in Rockefeller's workshop on the Earth Charter at the Millennium Summit in New York a couple of years ago, he informed the small group of us that was there that immediately after that Stockholm Convention ended in 1972, the participants in that, through the IUCN, set about compiling all of the environmental law in the world into one document, and that's the IUCN Draft Covenant on Environment and Development.
Now, this was Stephen Rockefeller, of course.
Yes, right. Professor Stephen Rockefeller, who's been charged with writing the Earth Charter. Of course, Maurice Strong and Gorbachev are charged with getting that implemented. And, you know, it's interesting, Dr. Stan, I was at one of the IUCN venues that where Gorbachev was on the roster, and apparently he had been hospitalized, and we never saw Maurice Strong. And they have both always had such a high profile at these Earth, these sustainable development conferences. And so they were both out of commission, which is very interesting. One of the most notable precepts about this document that was put together in Stockholm 3 years ago now is called the Precautionary Principle. And simply put, that's a reversal of the foundational United States legal concept, where we're innocent until you're proven guilty. And instead now, under this concept, you're guilty and until you're proven innocent. And I bring that up because I went to Africa a week early to attend an environmental law conference. And in the second half hour, maybe we can go into the implementations of the legal frameworks that have been set in place and that are being pursued and how all of this will affect us legally. But the precautionary principle is fundamental to Agenda 21. This was set into a law document 30 years ago, and we're just now seeing it brought into action. The stated premise that underlies sustainable development is that there are limits to growth because we don't have unlimited resources. So that's a premise that you need to understand when you're trying to understand what they're talking about doing with our environment and with sustainable development. If we have limited resources, then they argue that they must be conserved and taken out of production and protected from people. And if there are limits to growth, then you curb population, you curb any kind of development. And that has very, very severe implications for the way of life that we've become accustomed to in the developed and the industrialized countries. So therefore, in order to sustain development, you are going to have to protect the environment according to the plans that they have envisioned. And they've come up with this cute little phrase that supposedly sustainable development is about people, planet, and prosperity. So you have these little phrases that are, you know, touted around, but it's really not about people. It's more about Mother Earth and the prosperity of the few. And it isn't you or me.
And of course, in sustainable development, part of that is population control. I mean, there's too many people. They're consuming the elements, the products of the earth. Of course, that is not sustainable. So we have to cut production, and we have to cut the number of people utilizing the various commodities and such things. Which, of course, they say they're finite. There's only so much wood, so much water. We're running out of water. We're running out of wood. We're running out of everything. everything. And of course, the only way it's sustainable is to just slash a production. Would that be a fair statement?
Right. You create shortages because, of course, we know that wood and water are all renewable resources. And it was interesting to hear in some of these meetings, different individuals in the audience point out, well, but water, there will never be a war over water. The cost of desalination has become so low that it's, you know, it can be made available for everybody. And so there was a statement that was made in years past that the next great war will be over water. Well, that one's kind of blown away if you understand that we really do have these technologies available now to make water available to everybody. But if that technology were not available, then they would continue to march on their way of creating these scarcities of resources that are really, you know, the lifeblood of every human being. In fact, they will be, they are attempting to control all of these to withhold them from people. In fact, you know, the business, when we talk about moving into action, it's the business community that is now at center stage. And when you talk about privatization of water and you talk to people who are customers, consumers of privatized water, people I spoke to in Africa said that their water bills, you know, immediately tripled. And you hear of other people where their water bills have gone up 5 times. So that's the horror of the businesses who are partnering in this venture to bring a sustainable development.
The analogy would be here in the United States, this whole idea, we're going to deregulate electricity to drive the price down. Competition will drive the price down. Well, you saw what happened. They knew it wasn't going to work. This was a scam, and they got the people of the state of California to go along with the scam. And of course, it's going to just burden the state with, you know, I don't know, $20, $30, $40 billion of money. They bought future contracts out 20 years. They never could have done it if they hadn't created the crisis. They couldn't have created the crisis unless they said, we want to lower prices. We want competition. That's why we're going to deregulate electricity. And they're doing that with water. Well, we don't want municipal water works answerable to the people. We want, you know, a privatization. A privatization gives you lower prices. Well, if you believe that, if you believe you have a monopoly that's going to give you lower prices, you probably believe your WorldCom stock is going to soar next week. Go ahead.
I guess, you know, one of the things I'd like to look at is how this Agenda 21 is being implemented. And I'm looking for a little booklet that I picked up there, but I reviewed it today, and let's see if I can remember what's in it. It was subtitled Creating a Change Agent. Well, where have we heard about change agents? That's the operative in communism, using change agents. And we know that they've been at work here in the United States for years, undermining all of our institutions and our culture, our infrastructures. 92 Rio Earth Summit set out a very detailed plan of action for the 21st century. We know it as Agenda 21. What that agenda dictates, and we're talking about Agenda 21 because we've got a sophisticated audience here in the area that's heard of it, although most of the people in the United States have never heard about it. But it dictates that sustainable development is not a choice. It's a necessity, and it involves collective responsibility. Well, to understand the gravity of that, then we have to understand the collective versus individual liberties and rights. This collective responsibility is action at the local level. And it's Chapter 28 of Agenda 21 that mandates local authorities implement sustainable development in partnership with government, with business, and communities. And that word partnership is key because that is, that's the vehicle by which sustainable development is being brought down on top of every single individual, is through these partnerships with government, business, and communities. And that's where you get the phrase, think globally and act locally. Sustainable development plans, as some of us know, involve every imaginable area of your life.
And really it's regulation of every aspect of life, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And we had people there talking about not just monitoring, but policing. We need to move from monitoring to policing. So they're talking about a big, big police state. It involves environment. It involves our housing. It involves every aspect of our economy, our transportation, our land use, agriculture, education, population, public health, energy, water management, and more. In fact, you can expect this agenda to come right into your bedroom and then manage your life from the cradle to the grave. Local authorities have a key role to play in implementing Agenda 21. But what these articles point out is that the civil society, your non-governmental organization, the people that are involved with implementing these radical ideas, they don't need to wait for local authorities before getting involved with Agenda 21 issues. So local Agenda 21 is about creating change. But they say that before a physical change can be initiated, a change in perception is required. And so local Agenda 21 is about action. And if you'll think about action here in Santa Cruz County, you have different processes where you identify a target area. These people identify a target area. And then they identify the stakeholders to participate in this change. And then they have a visioning process. Well, you've all heard of, you know, Vision Pajaro Valley. You've heard of the visioning process on La Selva Beach. You've heard of visioning in all of these little neighborhoods, Coralitos, all throughout the area. So it's not, you know, something unique that, you know, some clever stakeholder just thought of in your neighborhood. It's something that came from the Rio Earth Summit, the Agenda 21 document. It's a blueprint for implementing this radical plan on every single human being in the entire world.
In other words, what they want to do is they come in, they say, we want a vision for our community. We're all going to get together and talk, and we're going to vision together. They've already decided exactly what's going to happen, and it's all going to go along with Agenda 21, but you got to sell the suckers that they have an input in it, that this really is for their benefit, and not part of this this great plan that has been laid out by the elite, by these people of great wealth, of how you are going to be controlled.
Exactly. So, you know, if anybody has been duped into being a part of one of these visioning groups or these stakeholder groups, or the business council, which is just, you know, it's the local version of the International United Nations Business Council, you know, you can claim ignorance so you don't look so stupid anymore and disentangle yourself from these groups, unless, of course, you know, you're a communist and, you know, that's your ideology.
But, of course, you know, even the communists don't understand it. I mean, they think that they're, you know, organizing, they're going to get around these people of great wealth who they dislike so much. They don't understand that what they're really doing is carrying out the programs of the people of great wealth. And by centralizing power in government, they're giving a power to the very people they oppose.
Well, and I think so many of these people have, you know, a power drive, because they're complimented and told that, you know, they're going to be the ones who will be enforcing, and of course they're being empowered to initiate legal actions to overturn. That's why I call most of these people social misfits, because it's here that they've been given the recognition, I think, that they probably crave, that they have not normally been able to derive in mainstream society. Just an observation. What can we go to next? I'd like to talk about, you know, one thing I do want to mention is the way the United States is viewed by the rest of the world. There was not a single question and answer or a press briefing that went without criticism of the United States, leveled either by people on the panel or members of the audience.
Well, we're going to be back here in just about three and a half minutes with our special guest this evening, Joan Paris, just back from the international meeting there at Johannesburg, South Africa. And Joan certainly is well qualified to attend these meetings. She's been to many of them before. She knows many of the leaders of, and of course she's there as a member of the press, so she can get into things that other people can't. And of course, we'll be back in just a moment with Joan, and we're not going to take any calls until she's said that what needs to be said, and then we'll open our lines at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there in the listening audience, we hope that many of you will decide right now that you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day. And starting at 7 in the morning and ending at 10 o'clock at night, and then doing two programs on Saturday, although one of them we do pre-record now, and the other one we do live. We have an opportunity to reach out across America on over 50 outlets, beginning to bring people some real understanding of what's going on. And it's really encouraging to see how more and more people are beginning to see how the various parts of the puzzle fit together. As they say, they're beginning to link the dots together. And so if you'd like to become part of our team and join the Radio Liberty family, because that's how we do what we do, if you'd like to partner with us, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters, certainly our July newsletter dealt with vaccination. Our August newsletter dealt with the Oklahoma City bombing, written by Colonel Craig Roberts, who had actually been part of the investigation. He had been asked by the FBI to work and provide information for the FBI about what and who was really behind the bombing. Of course, during the early days, first couple of days, why they were looking for the Islamic terrorists. Well, that's exactly what Craig found. I mean, there was obviously Islamic terrorists there, and they were tied into Timothy McVeigh. Not only that, but they were tied into the Philippines. Down later, they found this in Osama bin Laden. But, of course, the FBI wasn't allowed to investigate that at all because orders had come from above that they were not to look into the Islamic connection. Had the truth come out as far as what really happened to the Murrah building, we probably never would have had the attack on the World Trade Center, but the American people were not to be allowed to know about that or the Islamic involvement in the downing of TWA 800. And if you doubt that they were involved, well, they bragged about it in their publications in Europe, according to Josef Bodansky, who's director of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare, and his book, Bin Laden, the Man Who Declared War Against America. But you see, the American people aren't to know that. They're to believe it was an explosion of the central fuel tank, although almost 200 people saw the missiles going up. But it's amazing, if you say something ridiculous often enough, people will believe. And so the problem we face today is the American people are not being told the truth about anything. And our job is to bring you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, a really understanding of the spiritual nature of the forces molding what the American people believe today. Well, back here to Joan Paris and more on her recent trip to Johannesburg, South Africa, and bringing us an understanding of what is really happening behind the scenes as we're focused on the coming war with Iraq. We don't understand that this is really all about, of course, bringing about the New World Order. This would be the third try to establish of the One World Government, which, of course, will be the end of freedom and the end of America, as we've known it forever. All right. Well, with us in studio is Joan Paris. Joan, why don't you just go ahead and pick up the story?
One of the ideas I'd like to convey to the listeners, Dr. Stan, is the way the world views the United States. There isn't any venue that goes on in these meetings where the United States isn't bashed. And as an American, when we realize the billions of dollars that we provide to run these international institutions and that we dole out in aid, it's a little bit disconcerting. But part of this sustainable development agenda, which requires the control and reduction of consumption and resources, and this philosophy that our resources are finite, provides the fuel that makes us objects of the scorn of most of the rest of the world. We are mocked in these venues as useless feeders because we're over-consuming the Earth's resources. And we are constantly insulted as using exponentially more than our fair share of the Earth's resources. You need to know that in these international meetings, Americans are insulted for not giving more money to the rest of the world, and they expect us to completely tear down all of our trade barriers and terminate the subsidies that we have within our country. Now, I have to tell you, when the president of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, spoke in the UN plenary session, because you realize that the head of every government has 5 minutes to give a speech throughout this spectacle, the press room erupted in cheers and applause. Well, who's Robert Mugabe?
He's a communist.
The United States has criticized him for his racist policies of murdering and imprisoning and forcibly removing white farmers from their farms. And of course, that means that all of the black workers who have been there are also kicked off. And this is under the guise of land redistribution.
Yeah, of course, he's redistributing it to his sister and all of his friends, not to the blacks that the
exactly, to. Exactly. And we watch this on the television there, and you see these poor, like, 70-year-old woman, you know, in prison garb, shackled, and it's just unbelievable. So this is the kind of clown that your international media and your representatives of the United Nations are cheering for.
But don't forget, Joan, we brought him to power. The Rhodesian people elected Bishop Mezaweo, and we would not accept him. We insisted on Mugabe becoming the ruler there, and we promised them if he ever got out of line, we would come to their aid. We would be there. Henry Kissinger gave his solemn oath. And, of course, Henry Kissinger's solemn oath, and $2 to buy a cup of coffee almost anywhere in the world.
Well, and we've created a lot of these shams all over the world. So this is what this one is doing. And in fact, it's true, these farms have been redistributed to Mugabe's wife and their relatives and his political cronies. So it's really horrid. What's going on. Now, Colin Powell did give a presentation again as head of the United States delegation there at the summit. He criticized Mugabe, and he was booed and mocked and jeered. It's almost like you've got this like a spoiled child that only will tolerate you as long as you're, you know, giving them candy. And it's just, it's kind of amazing to see this, and I just think the American people really ought to be aware of what the rest of the world thinks about us. I'd like to explain some of the things that the United States is involved in. Now, Colin Powell, of course, was the official head of the United States delegation, but he showed up, he was whisked in for a day or so, and then, you know, was gone. The real figurehead, and I met this man in Mexico at the Financing for Development conference, was John Turner. He's the Assistant Secretary in the United States Department of State as the head of the Bureau of Oceans and International Environmental and Scientific Affairs. I first saw John in Africa at the Environmental Law Conference I attended in Durban. And John kind of breezed in and breezed out, and he basically told the international people gathered there that the American people are committed to leading or being a leader in this campaign to sustainable development. He pointed out that President Bush has pledged the largest increase in this nation's history in overseas development assistance. he said that Bush has made a commitment to these partnerships that we mentioned earlier, and that they will also continue to make many, many other contributions in this plethora of programs the United States funds. Mr. Turner called this a global campfire. Now, it's interesting to go to Mr. Turner's biography and find out what his qualifications are for this position that he is so adequately fulfilling in the implementation of Agenda 21. As the head of the United States Department of State, he's in charge of programs and activities concerning HIV and AIDS and other infectious diseases, the environment, climate change, all of our ocean affairs, science, and technology. And before Mr. Turner was appointed to this position, he was the chief executive officer of the Conservation Fund, which is a national nonprofit organization dedicated to public-private partnerships to protect land and water resources. He was very, very successful at what he did. In his tenure, he protected more than 2.8 million acres of parks, wildlife habitat, and open space across America. His experience prior to that, between 1989 and 1993, was as the director of the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, where he was responsible for expanding collaborative approaches under the Endangered Species Act. He increased wetland protection and established 55 new wildlife refuges, the most of any administration in the nation's history. He has also formerly served as the board of chairman of the board of directors of a bank in Jackson Hole. He was a chairman of the Institute of Environment and Natural Resources at the University of Wyoming, and he has other past board of directors affiliations with the Land Trust Alliance. You need to look that one up on your internet. It's a vast wealth of information on environmentalism. The National Wildlife Refuge Association, and there's more. But anyway, I was amazed at the depth and the breadth of this man's involvement in the environmental agenda. This man is not a figurehead, but he is one of the few people who truly understands and is very effectively implementing sustainable development in the United States. I was fortunate and happy to get an invitation to the briefing that Colin Powell had. And at that briefing, Mr. Powell explained a public-private partnership that the United States has become involved in. And I'd like you to know how this works. This is a system of parks in the middle of Africa. It involves about seven or eight countries. And one of the things I asked Mr. Turner if this involves what's called a debt for environment swap. Learned about debt for environment swaps from the IUCN.
Now basically, they owe the West a lot of money, so we write off their debt if they give us a good deal of the country. Is that how it works?
Exactly. And the environmentalist who is handing out press packets, I asked him, I said, so basically these are core biosphere reserves. And he said, kind of looked at me cross-eyed, like, what do you know about biosphere reserves? And he said, yes.
In other words, you're one of the few people who can talk their language.
Exactly. And when you bring up some of these documents and some of these terms, they kind of like, well, who are you and how do you know? Why do you know?
We've got Jeannie on the line here, but I want to get back to this because I think it's so very, very important. Jeannie, did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I'll be brief. And Joan, it was great for you to go all that way to get the info. And I'm so glad I quit Nature Conservancy 7 years ago.
Uh-huh.
You listened to the wrong radio program.
You know, and I'm still an environmentalist.
We all are.
Yeah, sure. While you were going down to Africa, I just want to tie it in just real quick what happened here in Santa Cruz. Saturday and Sunday, they had Gaia Song Conference, and they didn't say one word about Local Agenda 21, not one word about United Nations, because they know it's taboo now in Santa Cruz County.
But Gaia's all right.
Oh, Gaia. I'll tell you, I know they do their worshiping in the early morning, so I got there before they started. And here's this lady coming on stage, slithering on the stage on her belly, and she had these flowing silk robes, and she was Gaia. And she danced around, and they did say that we come from Mother Earth, and we come from the Earth. We come from Gaia. It was all spiritual, and they said, now, this is not religion. This is values.
Well, and it really has to do with worship of Mother Earth.
Yes.
The ancient pagan religions of Babylon of the Medes and Persians.
And I, being an environmentalist, I was there just to get information how to help myself and clean up the earth and so forth. But they got this crazy project going on, and people can go into it if they go into www.environmentalcouncil.net. And Joan, does that ring a bell, Environmental Council? Aren't they the facilitator that created Local Agenda 21?
Well, the facilitator is International Committee or Council, International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives.
So, right. But see, that's ICLEI in Canada.
Uh-huh.
But for the local community, it was the Environmental Council, which I have papers on.
Okay.
Where they have all the lists of the local organizations. But they're going to create this sustainable community in Natural Bridges. And there's a place you can click on. It's a 10-acre site. It's going to take 8 years, and it's a multi-million dollar project. They didn't say how many millions.
It's just lots of.
And so we got to follow this because, see, now they're going into action, and the NGOs have played the part, and now they're bringing this to the Santa Cruz City Planning and Building Department. And so this ties right in what you were doing in Johannesburg.
Well, and I'm glad you pointed that out, Jeannie. I saw that in the newspaper when I got back from Africa, and I thought, my gosh, these people, they didn't miss a beat. They're here just, you know, the following weekend after Johannesburg with this global to the local. And it really very well embodies all of the philosophies and plans that they were articulating at the global level. So,
but
yes.
It's going on all over the world. This is what people don't understand. It's going on in your community, too. You just don't know about it.
Well, Dr. Stan, they did say, and I'm not sure if they say it in other communities, but Santa Cruz County was very special. It was going to be the model for the United States.
I believe that, and we've been the model for many things that have brought terrible disaster to this country, including the whole Medicare and Medi-Cal program.
Thanks, Joan.
God bless.
Thank you, Jeannie.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and you were telling us about Colin Powell, and Colin Powell was there, and of course he was talking about these public-private partnerships, and then you were talking about these reserves in Africa, these debt swap reserves. Looks like they've got a lot of land there. That now are these people going to control all the natural resources there, or what?
That's what it's about, Dr. Stan. This will control up to 49 million acres of the choicest, most gorgeous lands in Africa. And these are reserves of the biological diversity that's always talked about. And the United States is a major partner, a funding partner of this. It's one of their priority programs. When I was told that it will involve an environment a debt for environment swap. Apparently they don't have this fully structured yet, but we've done this before in the Philippines and other places, and we look at loans or debt that's owed to us. We cut it down to a percentage. They give us that money up front, and then in exchange for them agreeing to set up this reserve, we just dismiss the rest of the debt. That's a debt for environment swap.
Now, who owns the reserve? Does the local country, or do we own it, or does it fit under some sort of international control?
It comes under international control, Dr. Stan. And the reason these reserves are critical, one of the things that's going on right now is a Millennium Ecosystem Assessment Project, which is evaluating all of the resources in the world. And that's going on here in Santa Cruz County under the auspices of the California Department of Forestry, this assessment of all the resources. It's going on every place in the world. One of the questions we asked of different individuals back at Johannesburg is, what is the value that you're estimating is going to be put on all of the biological diversity? And we were given an answer of anywhere is between $1 point something to several trillion dollars per year, Dr. Stan. Several trillion dollars per year. Now, with your businesses moving in as your action component, they will be in a position to manage and participate in the concessions. What they are locking up here, Dr. Stan, is the mineral wealth of the world, all of the minerals, the oil, metals, precious stones, the wood, the forestry, the timber, the water, the agriculture, all of the animals and plants, the herbs, for pharmaceutical uses. There was launched at the IUCN on the event of this summit a program which is gathering the genetic material of every plant and animal, every type of food in the world, and it's being put into gene banks. I understood immediately the seriousness of this because I was at the World Food Summit in Rome in 1996, and at that time I was able to get my hands on a 100-page document called The Legal Framework for Food Security. I was able to connect all of this at this conference in speaking to Jacques Diouf, who's the head now, and in 96 was also the head of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. And I asked Dr. Diouf a question, who is going to have the ultimate control of all of the genetic material in the world? And he said, this material is being collected in public institutions, but he said, we have the ultimate control and authority over it. We, being the United Nations, the Food and Agriculture Organization, because he said, we have the legal framework and the legal authority over all of this. And do you understand the implications of having all of the genetic material in the world under the control of a one-world organization? That is starvation. That is control of whether or not you will eat, whether or not you will live or die, whether you will be happy or whether you will suffer and die miserably because of this one-world order. That was an amazing revelation to me, just not because I was surprised about it, but just, you know, to see over the years how these frameworks are set in place and how they're being implemented, how it's all being accomplished. So, no, this conference was no failure. It is simply marching down the path to the programs and the goals that have been outlined many, many, many years ago. Another point I'd like to make for the listeners is, Americans that are involved in the implementation of sustainable development. I was early on at the Johannesburg conference in a press conference, and we had members of the United States Conference of Mayors and a Harvey Ruven, R-U-V-I-N, who was a day clerk with a Miami-Dade County over in Florida. And Mr. Ruven was, real jazzed about this International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. And I asked Mr. Ruven, having come from the Environmental Law Conference and talking about correlative rights and, the rights that we Americans are accustomed to, you know, Agenda 21, I pointed out, there are only three cities, according to this ICLEI website, only three cities in the United States that refer to Agenda 21. And of course, Santa Cruz is one of them. And if that's the case, if we're hiding the word Agenda 21 from people, then we don't really see the etiology of sustainable development. It's really totally hidden in the United States. And therefore, you can't have public participation or transparency, which is, are two key things that they talk about. We have to have transparency. We have to have public participation. Well, this public that they allow into this is a very, very, you know, few people that are willing to go along with it. So therefore, it's, you know, it's, this process is really compromised, or is, you know, not even existent here in the United States. And so it sounded to me like the correlative rights get in the way of sustainable development, because these, in the United States, the correlative rights are individual liberties and freedoms, like private property. And sustainable development, on the other hand, is based on the needs of the whole, the collective, or the group. And so how can you reconcile those? And I have to tell you that Mr. Rubin, who is there from Miami's Dade County, told me that individual rights are just definitely going to have to take a back seat to the collective good.
Well, of course, this is the whole idea of communism and socialism, and, of course, eventually a rule by the elite, because, of course, somebody's got to be in control. Things don't just happen. Somebody's got to run it, and, of course, as most socialists and communists don't understand, the people who are really pushing socialism and communism are these people who believe in this elite concept, and, of course, they exploit the idealists across America.
Exactly. In fact, the keynote address at this environmental law conference, it was stated that Penuel Medina said, "We're here to right the wrong of unequal distribution of wealth." So it is about a redistribution of wealth.
But of course, they're going to redistribute your wealth, not the wealth of the very wealthy.
Right. They stated that they could create a new world order. That's what they're in the process of doing. And I did say I wanted to touch upon the whole legal aspect of it. The law, of course, brings together all of the regions, the local, the national, the whole world, so that sustainable development can be implemented. It's a program of consensus. Boundaries are becoming less important in this era of sustainable development. They state that there's a global need to protect the environment forcefully. And these are my notes from the conference. These are the kinds of words that were used.
Joan, we're out of time. We're going to have to get you back because I think this is really so important. Somebody just called in and said the mayor of Dade, I assume that's Dade County, where this gentleman came from, is a member of the ICLEI. That's the International Council for Local Environmental Initiative, says Jeannie. So obviously it all fits together, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All you need to do, you just need to be able to connect the dots, and you see this massive centralization of power. Our guest has been Joan Paris, who went over to Johannesburg as a member of the press, and, of course, is bringing us this analysis. But do we have enough for another hour, do you think?
Sure. What'd you like to talk about?
All right. We will, well, not tonight, but we're going to get you right back. And I hope you've enjoyed what you've heard tonight, because Joan is one of the most insightful people and really has a grasp of this unparalleled way. And I talk to a lot of people, but Joan understands you better than anybody I know. And so we'll be having her back here in the near future. And until then, we, of course, I want to bid her good night. And, of course, ask you out there in the listening audience to pray for America. To pray for revival, to pray for our ministers and our leaders, and please don't forget my ministry, Radio Liberty. Please pray for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.
great program. Let's go ahead and line it up if I can find that book. Good,
yourself?
Yes. I'm sorry it wasn't a more exciting evening, Steve, but as I mean, if you listen to what we're saying, you know, I'm pretty damn amazed.
You're aware that they're out there.
Yeah, and the thing is that most people went to that meeting and had no idea what happened. They just don't understand how clever and diabolical these people are, step by step. Just like the water eroding the way out of the mountain.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's, well, that's fine. I want to know what that's... I didn't want to interrupt you to ask what this law was. Okay, well, we need to have, you know, I'm not sure that the standard of support gets set on the people who really want to